say and spell your name for me.
Okay, it's Kristina, K-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, Bourne, B-O-U-R-N-E.
Okay, thanks, Kristina. Yeah. So we're going to start with a couple of basic background questions.
Sounds good.
What is the date and place of your birth?
I was born in Great Falls, Montana, August 5th, 1971.
Okay. How would you designate your race?
White.
Okay. And what is your ancestry or ethnicity?
I am 50% Irish, and I don't know the percentage. My dad comes from two Irish. A mom and a dad who are Irish. So I'm 50% Irish, and my mom is German with a little Dutch, probably mostly German.
Okay. How many male and female siblings do you have?
I have one brother and one sister.
And what are their names, and where do they all fall age-wise?
Sure. My sister's name is Tony, and she is 8 years older than I am. And then my brother is Brett, and he is 2 years older than I am.
Okay.
And then I was the baby.
All right. How do you spell their names?
T-O-N-I and B-R-E-T-T.
Okay. Thank you. What is the name and occupation of your partner?
Tim. T-I-M. And his last name is Valentine, like Valentine's Day.
Okay. And tell me about your son.
Daly, D-A-L-E-Y, and he's 2.5 years old.
Okay. Is he your only child?
He is. We've had two miscarriages, so we've tried to have another baby, but have not been successful yet.
Okay. Where did you attend school, and what degrees have you earned?
So you want me to go all the way back to... Like, what do you think that's getting at? Like,
Why don't we start with your high school?
I was raised in Fargo, North Dakota. I should probably point that out. So I was born in Montana, but raised in Fargo when I was four. So I went to elementary school, junior high, and high school all in Fargo.
Okay.
Then I did my undergrad in Duluth at UMD.
Okay.
And my graduate work in Massachusetts. Which will come up probably in a lot of detail as I talk about the other stuff.
That sounds good. And is there anything else about your general background that you think is important for me to know?
I don't think so.
Okay. Oh, and I met your dog. What's your dog's name?
Oh, Nilla. N-I-L-L-A. I don't know why I'm spelling everything now all of a sudden just because you asked me. Yeah, I meant to tell you that she would be greeting you at the door. I hope you weren't afraid or allergic.
No,
or
no.
Okay,
I
good.
Love dogs.
Okay.
I miss my puppies at home.
I bet you do. So. Yeah.
So could you describe your relationship with your parents and siblings when you were growing up?
Sure. Okay. Relationship with my parents. I would say I had super supportive parents.
Okay.
They came to a lot of my events. They supported me in the things that I wanted to do. I would say a fairly average kind of relationship, meaning that there were good times and there were hard times with them, especially when I was becoming a teenager, that type of thing. As far as my siblings go, my sister, who's 8 years older than I am, who has been my best friend probably since junior high when she went to college, and since we remain very, very close. So she played a huge part in my upbringing because she was so much older than I was. She had already gone through a lot and shares a lot with me. And then my brother, who's 2 years older, I would call us estranged. That would be the word I'd use. We don't have much communication now. It's kind of spotty. And growing up, we did not have a close relationship whatsoever.
Okay. And what about the community and neighborhood where you grew up? Probably more in Fargo.
Yeah, Fargo. Yeah, I have no memories of Montana. Fargo is a community about the size of Duluth, I think. Maybe it's slightly larger. Or Duluth, I meant Eau Claire. I'm thinking it's like 60, 70, 80,000. I don't know. So it's a very similar community to Eau Claire. We grew up out of town. We grew up 2 miles past the airport, which at that time was completely rural, except for the fact that there was a small row of houses that all got built around the same time. So it was like a neighborhood, but once you moved past, you know, the house across the street, it was all farm fields for miles and miles and miles. So I can't say I didn't grow up on a farm. I didn't grow up around farmers per se. Like, the people who owned all that lived even further out. But I definitely grew up in the country. Like, it was not a city, but there were houses around us. So I think the original line of houses, the one we had, there was maybe like 8 or 10. And then across the street, we called it the Triangle. They probably built another like 10 houses by the time I was growing up. So maybe 20 houses.
Okay.
And then now if you go, it's all houses. All those farm fields are houses.
How many kids were in the area then?
Yeah, it was kind of, there were lots of kids. I mean, in the sense that I could tell you, you know, I could tell you exactly who lived in each house and who I played with. And there was, you know, I'd say half a dozen of those houses had kids around our same age.
Okay.
So we all rode the school bus together. We played on weekends together. Those were the people I played with.
Sure. So were they probably pretty racially similar to you ethnically?
100% white.
Okay.
And as far as social class, like, we knew who there was like one, what we called the rich family, but I wouldn't actually now know, understanding social class a little bit better, I wouldn't really even have considered them all that rich.
Okay.
But I would say we're all fairly middle class.
Okay, thank you. So how was your family, or maybe was it not connected to the community, to the neighborhood? I suppose that's really two different questions in this situation.
Yeah. I think how to answer that as far as the neighborhood goes, like I said, we're all kind of, it was a small neighborhood, so we all played with each other. We all went to each other's houses. So our families knew their families and their families knew ours. I wouldn't call it a close neighborhood. Like, we didn't have barbecues or things like that I think people do now. My dad was a high school teacher, so he was highly involved in the community, like the Fargo community. He knew a lot of people, and he also enjoys talking. And so when we would go places, we would, like, if we went to the grocery store, what should have taken 10 minutes would take us an hour because he knew people and loved to talk to them. So
yeah.
I don't know if that quite answered. I'm not quite sure what connected means, so I don't know.
I guess what, with your dad teaching in the high school, what different power aspects did that give your family? Was he maybe... I don't know if it affected neighborhood relationships at all, or did it keep him maybe more involved with the community in Fargo?
I mean, we were highly involved with the high school community. I mean, everybody knew who he was, and he knew a lot of the students and other people involved. I don't know if it gave us any power or privilege. Yeah, I don't really know how to answer that one.
Okay, that's fine.
Yep.
Who did have the power and privilege, and how did it affect you and your family?
Do you know what that means? Like, what do you mean by who had the power and privilege in the community?
Like, one of my classmates in this class is Mexican-American.
Yeah.
And she was one of the only Mexican-American families. So she noticed that the men in her family had more power,
okay.
Relationship-wise, I guess.
I mean, clearly I grew up in the 80s, so, like, the 70s and 80s, so clearly there were gender, I mean, clearly men had more power than women. That was clear. That's a given. Racial and ethnicity, clearly white people had more power than people of color. I don't know if that played out so much because we were a pretty homogenous.
Okay.
Pretty homogenous society there.
Was there maybe a church or a political group that kind of sticks out that?
Not really.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay. So you were.
You're gonna ask me a couple more questions here about things, and I'm gonna tell you I just don't.
No, that's.
I don't remember. Like, things don't stick with me like that.
That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, I can think, like, yeah, Merrill's fairly homogenous, but the Catholic Church, especially, is stronger than, I feel like.
Yeah.
But.
The Lutheran churches were more prevalent than Catholic churches.
Okay.
But I wasn't aware of it at the time, and nor was it an integral part to my growing up.
Sure. Fair enough. Other than your dad teaching high school, did your mom work, or did he ever pursue any other occupation?
Well, my dad was military right before, he was a pilot, and a helicopter pilot, right before I was born, and then he got sick, and he had to get out of the military, and I guess he had some jobs right after that happened. I think he worked at a hardware store or something. I was less than four, so I don't have any memory of it, but he has told me since. And then he got that job in Fargo at the high school when I turned four, and that's what brought us to Fargo. My mom was not paid employment. When we were all young, she taught music. She was a piano. She took piano. Like, she was I would call her a pianist. Like, she was a musician. She took piano lessons at the university, North Dakota State University, took music classes, and taught piano to neighborhood kids. So that was paid, but I don't remember for how long she did that. I wouldn't say that was something she did for, you know, like my whole childhood.
Okay.
And then she went back to school when I was like in seventh or eighth grade to get an architecture degree because she'd always wanted to be an architect. So she went back, and she then did work. I think I was in high school at that point. Yeah.
Okay. And she got work as an architect?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
What lessons did you learn from your parents? From individually and together?
Yep. So, my mom, hard work, and if you put your mind to anything, you can do it. Like, if you want to go back when you're 45 years old as a woman and be an architect student and be not only one of the few women, but to be like 25 years older than your classmates, that clearly taught me. And how she did that was she would get up early in the morning and study before we got up. So she was able to put her mind to anything. My mom can do anything if she puts her mind to it. My dad, the things that come to mind for him are you embrace life while you can. Like, live it, love it, enjoy it, have fun. He's very generous. That was another kind of lesson or value he gave me.
Have these lessons shaped your life at all?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't be who I am without what they did.
Okay. What role has education played in your life?
Huge. I teach, so, I mean, I'm, huge. I don't mean to.
That sounds good. Okay. So, what experiences, social movements, or events, or people were important in shaping you as a feminist?
So,
I guess outside of, I don't know what else is
in
your story, but what about, what was in the news? What was going on around you?
I mean, well, clearly that Alina Bobbitt, I don't know if Alina is her first name, though. I don't know why that comes to mind. And I can't even really remember what that case was about, although I just remember that whatever the average rhetoric was around it was bothering me.
Okay.
But I didn't have any history or knowledge or language. I had nothing to respond to it, but I knew something was wrong with what I was hearing around me. So that was happening at that time. The women who were important in my life at that time, so as an undergraduate, were clearly the woman who ran the church.
Okay.
Made a huge impact on who I am as a feminist. My roommate, Nancy, was an incredibly strong woman, very different than myself in personality, but complementary. We were very close, and her way of thinking and her way of being impacted me as a feminist. I had another friend in college who was a mom, became a mom when she was, I don't know, 19 years old, 20 years old, and was sharing that with me. So what she was going through was just part of our everyday talk. How are you doing? You know, we were friends. So, but when I look back, that influenced how I see
the world. Was she married or single?
Single.
Okay.
Trying to think who else. You know, I worked at the Battered Women's Justice Project. All of the women there, and the men, there were several men who worked there, were highly influential in how, Kim is one woman there who, you know, talked to me and helped me kind of understand what was going on in the world. I think that probably sums up the big people at that time. And then when I moved to Germany and we were doing the traveling, it was books.
Okay, what books?
Actually, there was a woman when I left UMD, it was a friend of mine, Zoe. My going away present when I left Duluth was a bag of used paperbacks, all by women authors.
Okay.
So Alice Walker, that's how I get introduced to Alice Walker, Zora Neale Hurston, they're all there. I read them all.
Later.
All the famous, like, big name women authors.
Yeah, cause you
Marge Piercy, we talked about. I was reading her at the time. Zora Neale Hurston, thank you. Maya Angelou, I read all of her work at that time. So those women were really important to my life. Oh, Gloria Steinem, I read like all of her work when I was there.
With your books?
That I was reading a lot of books.
Reading in Germany.
Yeah, that was just important because at that time those were the women that were influencing me, were the women that I was reading. And
okay.
I was reading everything I could get my, anything and everything I could get my hands on regarding gender, regarding race, regarding class. You know, any issue, social issue that I could find, I read the book.
Okay. So what about, you mentioned a little bit about your women's studies in graduate certificate.
Yeah.
What about those women? What?
Yep. Though two of my professors are considered the forefront for feminist theorists in the field of organization studies. So they were and still are highly influential in how I see the world because they introduced me to the theories. Plus, I took women's studies classes, so all of those classes in and of themselves helped me. But the two of them, Marta and Linda, are by far the two that have shaped my academic feminism.
Okay.
Marta, M-A-R-T-A, and Linda.
So shaped your academic...
Yeah, they shaped my academic feminism. Like, they put the theory behind what I had been learning and reading about. Like, they gave me the framework to understand it.
Framework, language.
Language, yep.
Okay. Have there been any other social movements or events that have shaped you, or women, or people? Or what about Tim? How did Tim help you? You remember...
I know we went through it together because I can remember just being really, like I said, it was a hard time. I cried a lot and I didn't understand the world. And we went through it together. We questioned things together and he was just always there.
Okay. What resistance, if any, did you face from people you cared about when you disclosed yourself as a feminist?
Yep. None from Tim. just to put that into perspective, he was has always been and is continues to be incredibly supportive. He's also a feminist, so he has his own story to tell. Probably my family, my mom and dad didn't understand what I was going through in college because, like I said, it was so painful for me. It was hard for them as parents to watch me be so sad and angry and all of that. They accept me now. It's part of who I am, and they. I can give you an example of my dad, who's 75. We went to Ireland, I don't know, maybe 7 years ago. My dad and my sister and I went to Ireland to study genealogy because part of my goal is to finish the family tree from the matriarchal side. So, like, my dad's brother has studied traditional genealogy, so their dad and their dad and their dad and their dad. And I said, well, why don't we trace your mom and her mom and her mom and her mom? So that brings us to Ireland. So I've been there 3 times to do genealogical work. And one time my dad and sister came, we all went together. And so we're in the middle of Ireland, in Northwest Ireland, in a very rural area, trying to trace the McGowans, the 4 McGowan families that lived there, one of which was our McGowans, who left in the late 1800s, but wondering if there was any connection with the other McGowan families that were still there. So we found ourselves on one of the McGowan farms, and we knock on the door, and it's about 4:30, 5 o'clock, and Mrs. McGowan is cooking, and we introduce ourselves and say we're trying to trace our genealogy, and we have McGowans as family members. Could we speak with you for a little bit? And she says, well, sure, come on in. And my dad says, he continues to, maybe I'm telling this story a little bit backwards. I think we got to the door and my dad was the one who was trying to explain what we were doing. I can't remember who was saying it, but at one point my dad says, yeah, we're trying to trace our maternal line here because of my daughter here. She's a radical liberal feminist, or what do you call me? She's a liberal feminist. No, a radical liberal feminist or something like that. And the Irish woman response was, as she should be. Yes. It was awesome. So, which was really funny, not only because here's this farmer who totally thought that was completely normal that I should be a feminist. But on top of that, my dad used the words radical liberal feminist, which because I had studied feminist theory, I know that radical feminism and liberal feminism are absolutely opposites. So to put those two together was funny for me because they're not even the same theoretical strand whatsoever. But he doesn't know feminist theory, so I just thought it was funny because he was using words to him that are describing feminism, which is supposedly radical to him.
Okay.
And liberal, which I think he means versus conservative.
Sure.
But little did he know there's theories behind it, whichever ones there are.
Right.
When I didn't give him a theory lesson at the time.
Okay.
But I very well could have sat down with him. Yeah. Because my feminist radical, my liberal feminist, I don't know, it's a joke in our family now, but I can't remember what it is, what it was. It was funny, though.
Oh, that's amazing. Of course she is.
Of course she is. As she should be.
As she should be.
As she should be.
Oh, I love it. Is there anything left you'd like to describe about the process you went through as you decided to identify as a feminist?
I think that pretty much captures it all.
Oh, what about your sister? You were so close when you were coming out saying, when you were working towards your feminist understandings, how did your sister fit?
Supportive. She's just always accepted wherever I'm at, so supportive, and we have conversations, and she sends me things that happen at her work now that are gendered, and she's like, you'll never believe this happened, or yes, you will believe this happened. So she's aware of things now that we talk about. So yeah, she's just always been close. We've always been close, so It's just part of our relationship, kind of like a friend, kind of like Tim, for example. It was part of it.
Okay. That makes sense. Was there any issue with your brother? I know you said you're estranged.
We were not in much communication at that time, so he...
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, there's nothing to report.
Okay. Feminism has been described as a river with many tributaries.
I read this one. I gotta tell you, I don't really have an answer. I don't know how I would describe. I don't know.
Okay.
I would have to think about that.
Okay.
Really hard to try to, like, describe it that best fits my beliefs.
Okay. Is there any theory that attracts you more than others?
I like socialist feminist theory. That's
okay.
The one that I use the most in my research. And I know this is going to come up later, but one of the reasons why is I'm highly interested in how what we call the public and what we call the private are interconnected.
Okay.
So in the socialist feminist theory allows me to look at things like that.
Okay, sure.
But I don't know if that would describe my... Like, that was just such a hard question for me because I don't... It's... I don't really think of my feminism as a tributary, I guess. I don't know. Like, I understand there's diversity in feminist views, and I'm not sure where... I'd have to look at a map and then tell you which one fit me. I don't know.
And there is no map.
Exactly.
Okay. What meaning does the feminist statement, "the personal is political," hold for you?
Yeah, that's why... that's why socialist feminist isn't interesting to me, because it's the idea that what society deems as personal is somehow outside of the political. And to me, anything that we deem as personal becomes political. So, for example, I know that domestic abuse in the, you know, years and years ago, it wasn't seen as a legal issue because it was seen as just a domestic issue, something that was a relationship issue. Well, clearly we've shown that that's a political issue, that has gendered implications, and it's important to see it from that perspective. I think, you know, having kids is often seen as a private issue, when in fact children are a public issue, and how we treat the idea of having children impacts how women have opportunities in business, in society. So to me, what seems private is a public issue. For example, parental leave, maternity leave and paternity leave, that's a public issue. That defines certain things in society. So for me, the personal is political holds a ton of meaning, because I believe what happens in the household is a public issue. So, for example, how we divide household labor in our culture impacts how women and men are seen and the opportunities that they have. And so it's a public issue to me. It's
okay.
Yeah.
How do you define power?
I crossed that one out. Okay. I couldn't come up with... it depends on the situation. It depends from the perspective of the person, the cultural situation. Who are we talking about here, and what situation? I don't know. I X'd it out.
Okay. How have you negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity and masculinity?
Yeah. Through awareness, just being highly aware of why am I acting the way I'm acting? Why are people treating me the way they're treating me? Is it because of some gendered assumptions that I'm making, that they're making? Am I okay with that at that moment in time? Am I not okay with it? Just really being aware of the assumptions I'm making and the assumptions people are making about me, and deciding what I am going to do and what I'm not going to do. Because I don't believe that what my vision of the world, maybe this is my tributary, is that all people could embrace masculine and feminine together. And you can choose when you want to be be that way. And in fact, there might be other entities out there. So we say femininity and masculinity, but there might be another entity and another entity and another entity. And if we just had all those options out there and people could pick and choose whatever they wanted, regardless of whatever their sex was, then we would have a more holistic culture.
What have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a feminist?
Figuring out what it means to be a feminist, to live it, and to be okay with that. So I've often felt that I wasn't feminist enough. There are many times in my life, graduate work in particular, in women's studies classes, that I didn't feel like I was feminist enough. I wasn't, radical enough, and I don't mean that as in radical feminist the theory, I just mean radical enough, that I wasn't enough on the fringe of society that I was considered feminist enough. And coming to a point in my life where I'm okay with the feminism of living it my way, being aware of that there are other ways, and that's okay.
What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
So I actually had to get out my pen and figure out 25 years ago was 1985, right?
Yeah,
because immediately when I started answering that question in my head, I was thinking obviously of the women's movement, like the 60s and 70s, but that's not what the question's asking now, even though
right
when the questions were written, I don't know when these were written, but 25 years is from 1985 to now. Which was interesting to think about, because when I think of greatest achievements, I go back to the 60s and 70s.
Okay.
I don't go to the 80s. That's not where my head goes for feminism. So it was kind of a hard question for me to think about. So since 1985, what are the achievements of feminism? Clearly that there's more women in occupations that were traditionally male-dominated. I think that's important. There's more men in occupations that were female-dominated. I think that's important. I think FMLA that came in 1993 was a huge step. While an inadequate step for parents, it was a huge step. Are you familiar with FMLA? Okay. So I think that was a major milestone in U.S. history. Again, though, an inadequate one. That was like all I could come up with for like huge events for women. You know, I suppose Hillary Clinton running for president was a huge event. I guess that one's just super recent. When you ask me, though, I immediately go back to like the 60s and 70s.
What do you see as the biggest achievements from those?
The entrance of women into the workforce, by far, would be the biggest one for when I think of history. Again, I read all the history books. I just don't... Those are...
Why is it that you see the achievements in the workforce as the most important feminist achievements?
I don't know if I would have said it was the most important.
Or the ones that you're most aware
that's
of.
That's the one that comes to mind. Because I think that opened up the opportunity for women in what was called the public sphere, again, which is a assumption that there's a private and a public. But our culture's built on that, so I think it did offer opportunities for women to experience other things. It offers clearly financial independence. It offers empowerment. It offers a whole different set of opportunities. So I think that is very important. Like I said, my mom was somebody who didn't feel that once you got married, you had a job. So the fact that if you want a job, you can have one is really important. Not that everybody should. Not that all women have to work. That's not what I mean at all. I wish I had more time to think about this, because I'm sure there are more achievements since 1985. More equality in politics, more equality in the home. Well, it's not equal yet by any means. There's more, like, you know, incremental changes.
Trying to think just what else. Usually I'm right on top of this type of thing to offer suggestions. This isn't a multiple choice answer. You know, who you are and your interest in business obviously shapes the fact that you think that women in the workforce is a huge achievement of the feminist movement.
Yeah. And I'd like to say that universal childcare is, but I can't say that. Like, I think of Sweden and all the things that they've achieved as a country, because they're supported, the feminist values are supported throughout their system, whereas in the U.S. I just don't see. So feminist achievements is hard for me. I can tell you, like, there are 100, and as soon as you leave, I'm going to come up with all of the things that feminists have fought for, you know, like sick pay leave and I said FMLA. Oh, there's a ton, but
okay,
they're escaping me at the moment.
Oh, that's fine. What do you think are the most important challenges feminism must overcome in this century?
I think in the U.S. I would really like to see, I would be very happy if we could come up with a national parental leave, not just maternity leave, but parental leave policy. We're the only industrialized nation that does not have a national plan for parental leave. That doesn't mean that the other ones that have it have great ones. Like, 1 week of paid isn't great to me, but they have something. We leave ours up to the discretion of the organization. So every organization that you work for has a different policy. So somewhere you as a mom might get 6 weeks paid leave, somewhere you might get 6 weeks unpaid leave. As a dad, you might get 1 week paid leave or 2 weeks unpaid leave. So what you get depends on where you work, and so it becomes a class issue. It's clearly a gender issue. While we have FMLA, it's unpaid leave, which then makes it a class issue, because who can take unpaid leave, especially after adding an addition to your family? So, and it's all connected. It's connected to, you know, health of the mom, health of the baby. It's connected to the society and what we value. So to me, if we could overcome that, which will be incredibly difficult, that would be a wonderful addition. I think more women in leadership roles, whether it's business organizations or political, like in our politics, we still need to break barriers there. We have, you know, of the Fortune 500 companies, I think 8 are female CEOs, might be 7. Board of directors, I think it sits at 12% of board of directors are women, so those making decisions for organizations are predominantly men. Pay, equal pay for equal work is a problem we need to overcome. I think equality in the home, so division of household labor needs to be addressed. Who's doing what work? We have a lot of issues.
I agree. When you think about your life experiences, are there any other coming-of-age experiences that you'd like to share?
Yeah, when I looked at 33 through 42, this coming-of-age to me was what I was telling you prior. So
okay.
I really didn't know how these were different than telling you about my undergraduate experience in my new eyes, but we can try. I personally didn't know, but when I was thinking about coming of age, again, not knowing what that meant, I would say I have 5 kind of moments in my life, if I had to put a timeline together of how I came to be who I am as a feminist. The first would be that when I was a kid, I really had a passion for business. So I had that kind of desire to figure out creative processes for, in a way, selling things. So whether it was my handmade cards or my back rub company or, you know, my tea set with snacks on it, that was fun to figure out, what can I do with this thing and how can I make some money? We had to put half of everything we received or earned in savings for college in a little baby food jar in my mom's underwear drawer. And then once a, I don't know, 2 weeks or whatever, we'd go to the bank and we'd put it in. So I knew I was going to college from when I was 4 years old on, because I was saving for it. It was just expected I was going to go. I saved all the rest of my other half. Like, I never spent the money. So I just liked the idea of earning something with your creative ideas. So that's one moment on my timeline. The second moment was when I became a feminist as an undergrad, which I've told you that story already. That is clearly a defining moment for me, was that experience. The third moment was being part of the military community and feeling some cognitive dissonance between an institution that I was part of and my own individual values, and coming to terms with the fact that if we want to make change, we need to get into places that we want to change, because if we're always trying to change them from the outside, we may miss opportunities. Then the fourth would be my graduate work. There's no doubt by putting an academic language on what I was feeling and experience helped me grow as a feminist. And then the fifth is what I'm going through now, and that's raising a child. So how do you raise a child as a feminist parent? How do you raise a boy child as a feminist parent is what I'm going through in particular. So those were like that's my coming of age, which I've already told you pretty much all of those stories.
Okay.
This will be circular, which I know that's what a lot of women do. One thing I didn't tell you was when we were in Europe, I said I read books. That was one of my ways of learning and growing as a feminist, was reading. The other one was when we traveled, we always sought out the women's history, the women's culture, the women's viewpoint when we everywhere we went. So like when we would go to the art museums in Paris, like the Musée d'Orsay, of course we looked at the Manets and the Monets and all of the Impressionist art, but we immediately would go straight for, were there any women here? Can we find the women here? Who are they? And then learn about them. When we went to Ireland, we sought out Sheila na Gigs. They're carvings on stones that were often at churches and on archways that were of, I'm sure there's a way to describe this that I'm sure you could read a definition of a Sheila na Gig, but it's something to do with like an old woman and a young woman together. And so she's got like this old face, but she's got her hands in her vulva, like opening it up, and it has something to do with like, like the stages of womanhood, and then they were often used on churches for fertility, even though they have a pagan, I think they can go all the way back to like pagan or goddess type things. So we would like seek those out and look at them and try to figure out the history of them and how were they seen and what different perspectives. So the Catholic Church has a perspective on them versus, you know, another community. So we did that. We just did all kinds of things whenever we were traveling to try to make sure we had a full view of where we were, not just one perspective, but all kinds of perspectives.
Very cool. Do you know how to spell Sheila na Gig?
Not a clue.
Okay, cool. I'm sure I can type in Irish symbol.
Yeah. I think it's literally Sheila.
Okay.
The name. And then N-A-G-I-G.
That's fine. To what extent did your gender, race, social class, sexuality, or family situation influence your coming-of-age experiences and the way you made sense of them?
I mean, they clearly influence them, because I believe everything we are influences how we are. I don't know how to answer it.
Okay. In what ways were these coming-of-age stories transformative for you?
Well, all five of those made me who I am.
Are there any celebrations or public events that figured significantly as a part of these experiences?
Not that I can think of.
Were any personal losses resulted from these experiences?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know what that meant.
Did your dad or your male business teachers or your business mentors, even if they were women, did you lose any respect for them in gaining a feminist perspective on what you've been taught?
Not so much losing respect. It made me question a lot of stuff. You know, it just made it more difficult in the sense that you always had to be thinking. I think it was a lot... things were clear before I was a feminist. Part of being a feminist is questioning everything around you. Why is it this way? How is it this way? What assumptions are you making? Could we do it differently? What would it mean if we did it differently? So no, not personal losses in that sense. Just more sense of it's harder. Like you have to think more.
Okay.
The example I would give when I was an undergrad is I felt like I wanted to take my brain out and wash it because it just felt so full and so muddied and it wasn't clear anymore that if I could just wash it a little bit and put it back in, then things might be a little more clear.
What social scripts influenced your experience?
Don't know.
What was going on politically and socially at this time?
Because those five span from when I was a kid to today, I mean, I can't answer it. I don't know.
Okay.
This is kind of hard because for some reason this all seems to be connected to what we've already been talking about, so I don't know. It's harder to like tease this out.
Are there any other insights you gained from these experiences?
The only one that I haven't talked about was that fifth, that the moment now, which is raising a child. That would be the only one that you don't have in this tape already. And that would be having daily, and I'm later, both Tim and I are not young parents. I was 35, almost 36 when I gave birth to Daily. So... and having been a feminist since my early 20s, it's given me lots of time to think about how do I want to raise him. And we talk about it, I would say almost daily it comes up in our conversation, Tim's and I, maybe every other day, about gender and how society has definitions of masculinity, that boy children are supposed to inhabit, and what do we want to do with that? So the times that, what do we do? How do we raise them as feminist parents who are highly aware of gender and who want to, like I said, if describing what my feminism looks like, it's allowing everybody, regardless of what sex you were born, the opportunity to act any way that you want and to like any color that you want. It's really difficult to think that someday Daily will think pink is a girl color, because right now he doesn't know, because we've never told him, and we don't watch TV, so he hasn't been told yet. Someday he'll be told. So when he's picking colors out, pink is often the color he got to pick fabric for his horse, and that's the fabric that he picked. He doesn't quite know yet that colors are gendered. He doesn't know that that kitchens are women's domain, according to society, and that tools are men's domain, because he has both, and he can choose to play and make us coffee, and he can choose to fix a toy if he wants. But he will be told that, and we will have to talk to him about that, and he will struggle with that. And we will have to be open that he may choose to only play with the tool bench and not the kitchen set. And we will have to figure out ways to talk to him if he chooses to play only with the kitchen set and his friends make fun of him for it. Or He's got pink socks, and somebody said something the other day about his pink socks, and it was clear that their tone, that pink boys shouldn't wear pink socks. He picked them out. Those were the socks he wanted to wear that morning. So he wears pink socks. He's 2.5. What else do we talk about? So colors are a big thing. Language is huge. We talk a lot about language in the house. It was easier when he was learning words to say man. Woman was difficult because it was two syllables. And so when he first learned the language, like our driveway came up the driveway. It's fairly long. So the garbage truck comes at the end of the driveway and it's quite loud when it comes. And so he'll say, he said early on, the garbage man is here. And I said, or the garbage woman, because we can't see the person from our driveway. We can just see the truck. And I remember then the next time he said, the woman garbage is here. So he like picked up on the language. Of course, he transposed it, but he picked up on it. It's just fun to watch him with language. He just figured out that the pronouns. So he knew man and woman. He doesn't really know boy or girl. He just calls everybody kid right now. But he picked up on pronouns, and he'll say things like, this is my bear, he something, I'm going to get her a sweater. Like, he hasn't figured out, like, that's how gender is so socially constructed, and it's so clear when I watch him that he has to be taught how to assign gender. He has to be taught it because he's mixing it up all the time. And I'm trying to think of other examples of when. So language is huge. So he gets the pronouns mixed up because we don't force it. He can use whatever pronouns he wants right now, because he'll be told, it won't be long, and he'll figure it out, because language has rules and everybody else is going to use the same rules, and he'll figure it out. So like pink is a color. I'm trying to think. Tim, again, could answer some of these because he's here every day. Making sure that he has way more trucks. If you did an analysis of his toys, you would find way more trucks than, quote, girls' toys, because family members buy him boy toys. That's what they believe that he needs. So Tim and I made a conscious effort to go out and get him a baby doll, and he's got a really great baby doll set upstairs with a stroller and a bottle and a little baby bag that he puts over his shoulders when he's taken the baby for a walk, which was another thing. Here's language. So should we call the baby a she or a he? If we call the baby a she, then are we implying that all babies need to, like, girls need to be taken care of, that really babies are female domain, so we just associate them all with she's. And if we call it a he, then are we ignoring the fact that there are girl babies out there? And so how do we assign the gender to it? So we just let him, and he sometimes calls it a she, and he sometimes calls it a he, and he just goes with whatever comes out of his mouth. But we're constantly thinking about that. There's 100,000 things about language and how that teaches him how to act like a boy and how to not act like a girl. And we want him to act however he wants to act, fully knowing that he will be influenced by what society says. And he may choose to embrace what society says, and we'll have to be okay with that. I wish I could come up with more examples.
What did you say your childcare setup is for him right now?
We have college students from the university who come out to the house. So usually we have, like on Mondays, we have a student, Becca, who comes all day. She's here, she does the full shift. But most often it's somebody who does the morning shift and somebody who does the afternoon shift. We've had him since he was 6 weeks old. And Oh, here's some gendered stuff for you. And I have to just say this, they are amazing young people who come into our house and love him and care for him. And it couldn't be a better setup for us. We love our daycare situation. We're so fortunate. I have to just say that we're also highly aware of it's expensive because we pay per hour, whereas if he was at a daycare center, you'd pay a much less rate because you have more people. You know, one person's taking care of more people, whereas we have this one-on-one. But because Tim works from upstairs, he comes down and interacts with Daly on a daily basis. Daly was sick, I told you. He's got this hive reaction. So yesterday, even though Lindsay was here, Tim was down for a good part of the day helping, so the two of them were kind of tag-teaming it together. We love our daycare providers. Some of them have been with us since he was 6 weeks old, so they've seen him from 6 weeks to 2.5 years. And he loves them, but here's a really interesting gender thing. They're all women, and while we post on the UW-Eau Claire board, the job board, we've never had a man apply. For the job, we've thought about should we seek out men to apply for the job so Daly sees that men and women care for children, not just women. And we haven't done that. And part of the reason we haven't is because of time and convenience. It's just the people who apply, it takes forever to interview them and to hire them, and we're both full-time working families, so there's the rationalization for not doing that. But we're highly aware of the fact that he only is cared for by young women, and myself and Tim, and then my mom lives in town, and so she cares for him on Fridays, usually not this week. So when we're out and about, I got to go back to give you a little more context. Tim's a highly involved parent, so while he has all female, young female caretakers, his dad is, Tim and I would consider us really try to do equal parenting. Like there are no parent roles that I take on as the mom and no parent roles that he takes on as the dad. We try to change, like we just try to take care of him. So whoever has to do it, does it. It's not like this is you have to feed him and you have to do that, whatever. So he does see that at least a man takes care of him, but he doesn't have young men. So when we're out and about, he is very comfortable with young women, very comfortable, to the point like we went to a wrestling match on campus. One of my students is a wrestler, and he invited me to one of their matches. So I went, Daly and I went, Tim was out of town, and the woman that was taking the tickets as we walked through the door was a young college student like yourself, and very similar to our daycare providers. So we walk in, and I tell Daly, you need to hand the ticket to the ticket person. And he stands there. He decides to have a full conversation with her, telling her daddy's out of town, blah, 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 telling her, asking her questions. Highly comfortable. We were at a hospital. My dad had a stroke last week, and we went to the hospital, and one of his wife's daughter's daughter was there. I think she's in her young 20s. Took about 5 minutes, and Daly was hanging out on her lap, playing with her, talking to her. So that made me wonder, are we instilling in him that, you know, only women take care of children, but are we also instilling perhaps a comfortability with women so that when he's older, he'll respect them because he respects these care providers. Like he's learning respect early on. Will he respect them more later on because he had such a variety? All of our daycare providers are different. They're not all the same, even though they're all young women. They're all different, just like you and all your friends are different. Like, right. You're not all the same. And so they all interact with him differently. And so will that help him later in life respect women, which is one of our values that we want to instill in him, that you respect women. Will having them help him, but will not having a young man hurt him because he won't learn that young men should be loving and caring, but then his dad is, so does he see it there? So constant parenting, thinking and wondering, like, what are we doing and how can we do it and what's the impact going to be? And just how can we raise him to be a good person and be aware of issues like feminism and things like that? I can't think of any more examples. I wish I could. Maybe if Tim comes down, we can ask him. Because we talk about it a lot. I would say it's like a constant conversation. Or we'll do something, and will say, oh, look what I just taught. Look what I just did. I just role modeled X, whatever it is. Highly aware of the fact that that could teach him some sort of gendered role. Yeah, like we have to work on, for some reason, Daly has associated fixing toys with Tim. So if something breaks, he'll say, oh, Daddy will fix it. And so we've had to work really hard. So Tim will say now, yeah, I could fix it, but so could Mom. So let's see who has time to fix it, rather than just assuming that Dad's going to fix it. And we don't know how that came about. We don't know what we did that made him think that, you know, Daddy fixes things, because either one of us could fix it.
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you have any more questions about that or...
Nothing that...
Yeah.
Given what you know now, is there any way that you would like to rewrite or reframe any coming-of-age experiences, any childhood experiences?
I thought about that, and I thought, you know, I am who I am today because of that stuff, even though, like I said, that the undergrad, when I got my new eyes, was so difficult, and other moments in life have been too. No, because I wouldn't be who I am, and I'm happy with who I am, so I wouldn't want to change it, no.
Okay, I think that's okay. So how long and in what ways have you been engaged with the UW-Eau Claire Women's Program?
I started here 5 years ago.
Okay.
And the first interaction I had was when I was interviewing and had received an offer. I called Susan Terrell because she was the chair of the Women's Studies Department because I wanted to know what the atmosphere on campus was as far as, you know, equality, social equality went. And I had a nice conversation with her, and she was really open, and it seemed like it was a very supportive place, and there was a place for me and places to, you know, be a feminist and still be part of an institution, because while I talked about the military, education is an institution as well, and it's built on all kinds of policies and rules and regulations and assumptions that are built on men being professors and having wives who take care of the home front so that they can focus on their career as well. I'm a woman, and I don't have a wife to focus on the home front so that I can take care of my career. So I called her, and we had a nice conversation, and it seemed like there was a thriving women's studies community. So that was enticing. And then I did accept the position, and I came, and she welcomed me, which was really, really helpful. As far as my involvement with the program, I'm not a part of the official women's studies program in the sense that I don't teach any classes for them or have any cross-listed classes with them. But I have been involved, like I go to their retreat for faculty usually every year. I was a speaker at their last one to talk about feminist pedagogy. I won the Women's Scholarship Award last year for feminist research because a lot of my research is based in feminist theory. So I'm involved that way. I teach a gender and leadership class. So I do have, while it's not cross-listed with women's studies, it clearly has an affinity towards women's studies. And then much of the women's studies faculty or the people who are listed as those who have an affinity towards women's studies are, you know, my colleagues and friends. So that's important. I will say the rest of these questions are going to be really hard for me to answer because I don't know the program.
Okay.
I mean, I'm involved in like a few events here and there, but I'm not on a steering committee. I'm not part of their curriculum committee. So I don't fully understand the program itself, but I am, you know, I support them financially. I go to events, things like that. So.
Oh, that's fine. So how has the program changed since you've been involved?
Was the minor accepted recently? Was that the event? Was it the major, I mean? Was that just accepted?
Maybe.
Like,
that's a good possibility.
Like 2 years ago or?
I've only been in school here for 3 years, so.
It might have just. Are you a major?
I am.
Okay. It was just getting accepted when I came here, I think.
Okay.
Like it had just gone through. So I guess that would be one change. Yeah, but otherwise, again, because I'm not intimately connected with the program.
Okay.
I don't know.
I guess, and the only other program change I know, have you been aware of the enlargement of students and the expansion of, because I know this semester there's 15 majors enrolled, 30 minors, and like 15 or 20 certificate students.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, no, so, I'm not familiar with the numbers okay. over time.
I guess I wasn't sure if you'd have maybe an awareness of people being drawn to your gendered leadership class or anything like that.
That class is a College of Business class.
Right.
I only have College of Business students in the class.
Right.
So I don't get any women's studies. Well, I shouldn't say that because maybe they're minor. I would know that, though. I don't have students who are in the women's studies program in my class.
Okay.
Usually, very often, if at all.
Okay.
I have other students, like I had a student worker who was a sociology student who took a lot of women's studies classes, and we would talk a lot. You know, I have students that I interact with who take women's studies classes.
Yeah.
But they're not in my classes.
Okay. What are the major contributions of the UW-Eau Claire Women's Studies to the campus, community, and beyond?
Well, I think what you just mentioned, the idea that more students are taking classes and can get a degree in it, is a huge contribution. I think any of the intro-level classes are a huge contribution because it's introducing the ideas, it's putting seeds in people's minds, and while they might not major in it, you know, just like my class, these are people who are going to walk out in the world, and they can make change. We all can make change. So I think the intro classes are important for that. I think, well, and let me just keep going on. I think the fact that they support other women on campus who aren't necessarily in the program, that's what I'm saying. Like, I benefit from them. Like, they acknowledge my feminist research because it's in my field. It's not in women's studies. It's in organization studies, but it uses feminist theory. It's a feminist project. So the fact that they gave me the award and acknowledged my work it's major because it shows my colleagues that my work is legitimate and it's important. And it's important to acknowledge those that aren't necessarily like right in the middle of the program, but are making change. It's what I went to before. It's that you can make change even if you're outside or if you're inside an institution, you can make change versus just being in where it's easier to do it. I gotta go back. That isn't quite what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is I appreciate that they acknowledge people who are making change that are outside of like official places. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Just be, you know, your contributions to women's studies, even though they're not
to the program per se,
literally to the program, right, to the department,
but the values that they're trying to instill, I'm also instilling, but I'm doing it somewhere else, and so I appreciate that that's valued, that that's seen as still part of doing feminist work, even though I'm not in the women's studies program.
Right. So you're both in the same institution making the same changes, but within different departments.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Okay. Do you have any stories of people or events that you think are significant in shaping the 25-year history of women's studies at Eau Claire?
I don't know the 25-year history, so I can't answer that one. Although I did know, I thought it was great when they brought Gloria Steinem to campus. Was that before you came then?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it was 2007. 2006. Were you here in 2006?
No.
Okay. Yeah, because I think I was just pregnant with Daly when we went to see her.
No, I didn't even have my associate degree at that point.
Okay. Yeah. Because I think she came early on, like for the history of women's studies, and you probably will learn this or know it more than I do. But I think Gloria Steinem was here early on when the program was first introduced, like way, way back. And then they asked her to come back for the major. So that makes sense. That was 2006 when the it was a celebration of the major.
Okay.
And I just have to, here's a story for you to use. Gloria Steinem, a huge impact in how I became a feminist through her writing, no doubt. But I saw her speak. Let me go back so I can get the story straight. I saw her speak when I was a MBA student in Massachusetts. Tim and I went to Mount Holyoke. There were four authors speaking, four women speaking. They had written a book together on women's history, and they had come to give a talk, and each of them spoke. And after the talk, you could sign books, and I waited in line, and I must have waited we waited for, it felt like an hour and a half. I mean, it was just a really long time to have her sign the book, a book that Gloria Steinem had written. So I had the book that only she had written, not the new book that they were promoting yet. And by the time I got to her, it was seriously an hour and a half or 2 hours after the presentation. And my interaction with her was as if I was the first person who had stood in line. Despite that she had been signing and talking to 100 people before me, she was so present in that experience, and I'll just never forget it because it was so powerful for me to meet her in person, to have her sign my book, to be able to tell her that I bought her book on a military base, and for her to ask me about the experience. She actually asked me questions, and I got to talk with her about it. I just was, it was a very meaningful moment for me, and what it taught me was to take time and be present with people, even if you've talked to 100 people already. Because for that person, you're the first one there. And
right.
So she was amazing. And then so she came and we went to her talk. So in 2006, I guess it was.
Okay.
Yeah, she was one of my favorite people to see speak. Not necessarily in 2006, because I don't actually remember a whole lot about that talk. But the Mount Holyoke one, I remember because of that interaction with her.
Oh, I bet. Oh. What do you consider your major contribution to the success of the program?
I'm not going to claim any contribution to their success. I don't think I've had, I'm too tangential to the program.
Okay. What would you like your legacy in the Women's Studies program to be?
I don't think of myself as desiring to have a legacy in any program, so to have one in women's studies, it's a loaded word.
I agree.
So it's hard for me to answer.
What type of impact would you like to leave on the women's studies, or even on your department, but in a feminist manner?
That I can answer, because again, these are a little bit hard because they're focused on the women's studies program, so people who teach in it or are on their committees would be able to answer it, I think, a little easier than somebody who's listed on the website as, you know, being, I don't exactly know the wording, but on the website my name is there to show that I am, you know, I am part of the feminist movement. But I don't necessarily teach in the program or am involved, highly involved. So what impact would I like to make is the one that I make, and that is I have the absolute privilege to teach my gender and leadership class. It's an unusual class in a college of business. I have the freedom to design it because I teach it. And it's a wonderful class because it's probably a lot like how you feel when you take your women's studies classes. You walk out and you're like, wow, I never thought about it like that before. Or, oh my gosh, we need to change this. This can't go on. That's the reactions the students have in my class. And there's nothing better than helping them see the world differently and giving them language and information that can help them make sense of what they are experiencing but didn't know how to talk about it. And then to see the passion of, well, we're going to change this. This isn't acceptable. We can't have it like this. So I guess for me, the impact I make is that there's a space. There's a little space, and it's my class, that we can talk about this stuff and plant seeds. And someday, who knows who these students are going to be and what they're going to do and what great changes they're going to make in the world. Because at some point when they were at UW-Eau Claire, we had a class, and they were shocked to find out that only, you know, 7 or 8 CEOs of the Fortune 500 are women. And you know, once you get that little bit of knowledge, you're like, well, let's change it. What can I do? And we talk about that. What can you do? What things can you do in your life? And it gives them the space to struggle, and it gives them the space to be legitimized. And so I think that's my impact as far as women's studies. Plus, I teach all my other classes from what I would consider a fairly feminist pedagogical perspective, in the sense that I try not to humiliate. I try to have multiple voices. You know, just to me, my feminist values influence how I teach any class, whether it's a gender class or any other business class. So I think I have that impact. Plus, I do feminist research, so it's on my resume. So it, you know, I'm visible. People in my department know that I do gender work. So it gives a voice on campus that may not have been there in the College of Business.
Do you try to raise awareness of feminist issues and feminist learnings or understandings of business in your other, in your not gendered business classes?
Oh, in the
not
gendered business classes? Yeah. I can't not, because it's part of who I am. So if there's a teaching moment or an issue comes up, I always see it through my own lens. So I offer that perspective. In fact, it came up yesterday in class. We were doing an ethics case, and the students had to read it. And the protagonist is named Pat. And it's written in a non-gendered way. You don't know who Pat is. In fact, it's written so clearly that it will say he or she. It even says it in the case. And inevitably, when we have the class discussion, 99% of the people refer to Pat as he. And I always bring it up. I always say, look what just happened here. How did this happen? Why is it that we think that business people are he's? Before we even have, we don't even know who that person is. The language even, that it even says he or she. Like, it gives us the option, and okay. Students still tend to, and I do it too. I'll be up in class, and all of a sudden I'm saying Pat, he. And I stop myself and catch myself. So yeah, I bring up gendered language in class. We bring up issues of diversity in class. So yeah, it does come up. It can't not.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And again, not on the sheet, but this is the second time you've mentioned pronouns. Do you wish that there was a gender neutral pronoun?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be just, I wish our language had, language binds us, there's no doubt. It's constantly, and I constantly, like I said, I'm fully aware of it now raising a child, the language that we use. And it's always there. I think in the College of Business, when I came here 5 years ago, the chairs' offices, they have name tags or tags that hang down, and all of them said chairman. That was in 2005. It got changed in 2006 to chair. So even that, just that language, that it's already telling you who can occupy that office,
right?
Who that person's supposed to be, what they're supposed, you know, how they're supposed to be, even how they're supposed to act. I think language is really difficult. I play with it in the sense that, like, I usually try to use gender neutral, like when I teach, even though it would drive an English person nuts. I will say they, even though I'm saying the manager, they, even though I know that's not grammatically correct, but just to not assign a gender. So, or sometimes I'll choose to say she, or I'll choose to say he. But I often just choose to not use use a gender to just say the manager.
Okay, cool. As you think about the future, what role do you think that women's studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus, community, and beyond?
Well, I hope it will continue to grow, as you mentioned, with the student, the more students. I mean, really, that's why we're all here. And if more students are taking those classes and getting those majors, I think that would be wonderful. I mean, I think that's the goal. That would be the goal, is to have more students involved.
Do you see a potential impact for the larger number of students, how that might affect the Eau Claire area? Any changes in the community or the city or anything?
I guess I could just say, of course it would, because how could it not? But I can't really think of, I mean, yeah, of course it will. I mean, like, I'm just going to bring it back to, because I don't know the Women's Studies program, so for all I know, I don't know what they're doing outside in the community, so I'm sure there are things, I know they're doing things, obviously, but I don't know what they are. But like I said, every student who takes my gender and leadership class, at least a seed is planted, and they might make some change. They might do something differently in their life, in whether it's their work life or their home life or their community life or whatever part of their life it is. So I would imagine for every student who takes a women's studies class, the same thing happens.
I hope so. Okay. And what else would you like to share about the women's studies program at UW-Eau Claire and its impact, both historically and in the future, on the campus, community, and the world beyond?
I guess the last thing I'd share is I just wish I knew more to tell you, because I don't. I've been here 5 years. I'm, you know, not necessarily directly involved with the program, so I don't have a lot that I can share. But I love what they do, and I like I said, the first phone call I made after I was offered the position was to the Women's Studies Department to make sure that this was a campus that had a strong Women's Studies program. Because what they do, despite me not being directly involved in it, highly impacts what I do. So the fact that I can do feminist research and that it's legitimized in my department, you know, that they're aware of campus issues that they bring up to the administration, that impacts then what happens in my college. And so if they weren't doing the work that they were doing, it would impact me. So I'm glad that they're there, and I am not sure what I would have done had, when I called Susan Terrell, she had said they don't have a strong program, but I did make that call, so clearly it was important to me.
Okay. Any closing thoughts?
I can't think of anything.
Okay.
You?
Do you have any thoughts?
Oh, I mentioned earlier, how did you get, when you worked at the Battered Women Project, in your undergrad, how did you get connected with that?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Well, like I said, oh no, maybe that's who, maybe Tina can introduce me to the director of that program. You know what? I think that when I went into the Women's Studies office, like I mentioned, I think she either introduced me or gave me, this was long before email, so I clearly didn't email anybody. She might have given me a phone number to somebody, or did I see a job announcement?
Okay, so it's not...
It's not clear to me how I got there.
It's something you searched out, but... Like, that you weren't looking for a way to work...
Oh, yeah, I was.
...with women?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I was clearly looking to... When I graduated, I knew I wanted to work in a women's organization of some sort, but I don't exactly remember how I got involved in that, how I got that job.
Okay, but it was intentionally a women's...
Oh, it was incredibly intentional. Like, okay. I clearly knew when I graduated that I wanted to be part of a women's organization.
Okay.
This is really funny. I can't remember how I can, like I said, I can remember, I can tell you exactly what the office looked like. I can tell you about, you know, what we did. I can tell you about everything, but I don't remember exactly how I got that. I know I interviewed for it. I remember that.
Okay.
But yeah, when I graduated from undergrad, I didn't know if I was going to use my business degree because I had just got my new eyes and I was trying to figure out how everything fit together. So I consciously sought out that and then living at the women's transitional housing job. I remember that as well. I saw an advertisement for that and applied and got it. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.